From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Five healthcare workers from three different Chicago hospitals were the first to receive the coronavirus vaccine. After months of not knowing what to expect when they came to work at their hospitals this past year, the vaccine offers hope.
Hopefully the press will hound you day and night to find out exactly what you're getting in exchange for the stonewalling of this investigation.
Talking about a kangaroo court, the Republicans on this committee had their minds made up that Mike Madigan was guilty. The kangaroo court was instigated by you.
Opponents of the fairest long-term solution have put us in this situation. And there's only so much on the table to choose from when you have a government as hollowed out as ours is.
That was Governor J.B. Pritzker announcing plans to slash $700 million from the current fiscal year state budget, with more cuts on the way. Before that, dueling voices from the dramatic but ultimately anticlimactic conclusion of a special investigating committee centered on House Speaker Mike Madigan. And of course, this was the week we've all been waiting for, the beginning of the end of the COVID-19 pandemic with the arrival of vaccines in Illinois. We'll discuss all of that and more on State Week. I'm Hannah Meisel, in this week for Sean Crawford. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler. He's an emeritus professor and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. He's also a longtime State House reporter and observer. Joining us this week is Tony Arnold of Chicago Public Radio Station WBEZ, where he covers state government and politics. Thanks for being here, Tony.
Hey, Hannah. Thanks for having me.
And also joining us is Rick Pearson, chief political reporter at the Chicago Tribune. Thanks for being here, Rick.
Thank you, Hannah.
So let's begin with the state budget mess we are just starting to reckon with. The governor earlier this week announced his plan to kind of unilaterally cut more than $700 million from the current year state budget. And that's only the start of cuts, because our budget is the one that began July 1st and runs out at the end of June is nearly $4 billion out of balance. Rick, what cuts were put on the table and how realistic do you think they are?
Well, for the most part, this is kind of the low-hanging fruit cuts. It's things that governors traditionally do, such as hiring freezes, purchasing freezes, freezing grants. So for the most part, yeah, unilaterally, he can do that. You get into some other areas, though, like trying to save $75 million through furloughs and wage adjustments with public employees union. That opens a whole new can of worms. And you've already seen some pushback from AFSCME basically saying, wait a minute, Governor, we were one of your biggest supporters for that graduated rate tax increase amendment. That failed on the November 3rd ballot. We were one of your big supporters for that. Now you're going to try to take some of this budget cutting out of our hides. Think again. So that's just one indication of what is going to play out here for the next several weeks, where the cuts are really going to start getting hard because you're going to see the various forces of political opposition against them. I mean, we're not even talking about anything about education yet. And certainly as with the money that the state spends on education, there's going to be have to be some education cuts being looked at on the table as well.
Right. And Tony, I almost want to go back and listen to every press conference the governor has given since his graduated income tax plan failed on Election Day, you know, just to count how many times Pritzker has blamed Republicans for that failure. You know, given that almost like constant retreading of that issue, what was the reaction, you know, from different key players to the governor's proposals? And, you know, how does that bode when the governor says he wants to negotiate with the legislature for more than $1 billion additional dollars to be cut from the budget?
Yeah, I think part of what the governor is saying here is he's casting blame as much on Republicans, who I should add hold a super minority in the legislature, for a lot of the state's problems here, in particular for not coming up or proposing their own solutions to this, you know, economic budget mess that's primarily been caused by COVID, but also, you know, there's been structural historical problems with the state budget here. And you know, fair or not, that's, you know, this is the political reality that we're in. How much blame do Republicans get? Well, they certainly didn't lift a finger for the, you know, for the graduated income tax that would have raised an estimated $1.5 billion for this year and $3 billion each year going forward. And I think that there's this other X factor that's out there still, which is what Congress and the president are going to do in the next, who knows how long, weeks, potentially in days. I hesitate to even summarize it because what Congress is negotiating over keeps changing by the hour. But, you know, there might be some help for states in there from Congress and the federal government. There might not be. I think part of this, too, is just waiting to see what Congress does and what kind of extra money, if any, comes to the state to help plug this hole that maybe could get the governor out of this jam that he's in right now.
We are also borrowing $2 billion from the Federal Reserve Program that was made available to states earlier this year for this current fiscal year budget. To close the budget holes of last fiscal year's budget, we borrowed $1.2 billion. But borrowing means that we have to pay it back. Even with the, I think it was pretty low interest rates, it still means that we're on the hook for it. And that's why the governor decided, even though the legislature authorized $5 billion worth of borrowing, that we could only really sustain $2 billion. So Charlie, how bad is our budget situation we find ourselves in now? Are there any other times in the history of the state when we've been in such an immediate crunch?
Yeah, thinking back over it, there were times when we had the similar, what would you say, strains on the budget. And the way we've reacted in the past has been we've kind of delayed paying bills. We've also, I mean, we went 2 years when Governor Rauner was in office without any enacted budget at all. Now, the backlog at that time reached darn near $17 billion of bills that were sitting in the comptroller's office that we couldn't pay. Well, the backlog on Friday morning, the 18th of December, according to the comptroller's office, was $6,978,000,000. So our backlog isn't as bad as it had been historically. But the difficulty with the budget is the governor, as Rick said, went after a lot of low-hanging fruit. Okay, we're going to have a hiring freeze. We're not going to get any new equipment. We're going to restrict travel. We're going to do all these little things around the edges. But a lot of the budget is not available for the governor to cut without the legislature going along. For example, a big chunk of the budget is roughly $8.6 billion that is committed by law to go to the public employee pension funds for teachers, for state university retirees like myself, so I have a conflict of interest there, state employees, and that can't be skipped unless the legislature comes in and actually changes substantive law to say, yeah, we'll not make this payment this year, which they did. What it would have been in the mid-2000s, where they skipped or reduced the payment for a couple of years. There's $4 billion that we have to repay or send to people who bought our bonds, who lent us money in the past. So there's roughly, it's close to $13 billion out of the budget that can't be restricted without the legislature coming in and either changing the substantive law or reducing the appropriations. And I'm not sure that the governor is going to want to tell local school districts, well, we were going to send you $7+ billion under this new program called evidence-based funding, and we're going to reduce that. I mean, the commitment when this law was enacted a couple of years ago was we're going to increase it by, I believe it was $50 to $100 million per year until we get to where we need to be. By the same token, are you going to tell higher education, which is a roughly a $2 billion expenditure, that we're going to reduce you by 10% or 20%? I mean, a quarter of the money to higher education goes to the Student Assistance Commission to help needy kids pay for their college education. And if you go through the budget and look at the provisions in the budget and exactly what the money is spent for, there's really not a lot of room. And I guess what this preamble is leading up to is, it's my guess, and I'd put money on it, is that we will see a tax increase. And in a way, the irony is that the situation is more dire because the graduated income tax went down. And so instead of tax rates going up immediately for the wealthiest 3%, and maybe for the rest of us on down the road, now my guess is that they're going to go up immediately for all of us.
Sure. I mean, the governor, he keeps being asked, well, what about revenue? And he keeps saying that he's focused on cuts right now, but he and his team can see the writing on the wall as clearly as any of us, probably even more clearly. Well,
if I'm not mistaken, and you guys can correct me, Tony and Rick, because you follow this a lot more closely than I do. But in the run-up to the November election, if I recall correctly, didn't the Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton warn that if the graduated income tax amendment goes down, that we would have to see a general tax increase?
Of 20%.
Yeah.
Yes, she did. And then Pritzker kind of tried to downplay it by saying, oh, well, we'd have to look at cuts as well as revenue. But truly, throughout all of this, and going back to proposing his budget, he said without the graduated tax amendment passing, that there would have to be a new revenue, because that cuts alone couldn't do this.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, I thought it was interesting, though, you know, he chastises Republicans for being opponents of the graduated tax. But at the same time, you know, he dearly wants them to be part of any politically adverse solution, like raising taxes, which no, Republicans aren't going to vote for that. But he'd certainly love to have them on a vote that requires some very determined spending cuts. And basically, by alienating them, Republicans are just sitting back and saying, hey, it's a self-inflicted wound. We told you guys, you fix it.
How is it politically viable to pass a tax increase when you see the results of that November referendum? I mean, voters, you know, how does that go in the legislature?
Tony, you're exactly right. And that was part of the Republican response too, was if you think you can do a tax increase, look at that vote. Look at people and how their views are on trusting Springfield with more money. You know, I could see a better chance in a lame duck session, but I certainly don't see a new General Assembly moving forward with one of its first efforts is approving a general tax increase.
Sure, because they're already on the road to re-election come January. I mean, petition passing starts in September.
Yeah, but I would say part of the difficulty is, and no offense to people whose lives are overwhelmed with the pandemic, with trying to put food on the table for their kids, but I think people don't really have a good understanding of how the state spends its money. There was a news conference the other day by a bunch of lawmakers saying, well, we should close tax breaks, these corporate giveaways, and that would help us solve the problem. Well, if you look at what the tax breaks are, and the comptroller puts out a report annually laying them out, the largest tax break, if you want to call it that, she calls them tax expenditures, is $2.2 billion that the state foregoes by not taxing retirement income, like most other states do. The exemption of food and drugs from the state sales tax costs us $1.9 billion. The personal exemption is $1 billion. The property tax credit is $600 million. And all of those things, which are the largest, if you will, loopholes or tax breaks, they all affect individuals. The largest break for corporations is where they get adjustments to their state income tax And that's only in the $400 million range. So it's not that the money is laying out there. Most of the money we spend goes for human services.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Hannah Meisel, along with Charlie Wheeler, Tony Arnold of WBEZ, and Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. So not to rush the holidays, but we are coming up on the new year, which means we're really coming up on the date that every normal person's calendar, the seating of the new General Assembly on January 13th, which is when the House and Senate members formally choose their leadership, setting up a fight over House Speaker Mike Madigan's continued speakership. So, Tony, this week we saw Madigan allies kind of abruptly shut down an investigative committee before it could actually even do any investigating. Catch us up on what we saw there.
Well, what we saw here is about 2 months of back and forth and bickering over whether this was a legislative investigation that would unearth new truths about ComEd's relationship with the speaker here, or whether it was a political circus sideshow meant to help Republicans win seats in November's election. We didn't get much of an answer on either side of it because the hearing, the committee's been disbanded now, and Madigan's going to walk away from this attempt by the Republicans without really any added extra damage to his reputation than what's already been done by the U.S. Attorney's Office in Chicago, because Democrats, you know, this is a six-member panel, three Democrats, three Republicans, and you just needed the three votes from the Democrats to say we're done here. What they did get, what the public saw, what reporters saw, is a little more than 100 emails internal to ComEd. They would not have been public otherwise, that showed associates of Madigan, particularly Michael McLean, writing emails, having conversations over email with ComEd executives or lobbyists about certain matters that he said, McLean said, were important to the speaker, or inquiring things on the speaker's behalf. There's a similar situation in these emails that you have with the indictments that you read from the feds, which is that is Madigan directing McLean to say these things, or is McLean taking this upon himself? It's not clear. And that's why we're in the position that we're in, which is that Madigan's not been charged with anything. And he can say he's done nothing wrong and deny any kind of knowledge about any of this that's happened. So that's about where we are. And now we have one less committee to look at here for this ongoing, very broad sweeping corruption investigation that the feds apparently are still conducting.
Sure. And the thing you said about McLean, was it him carrying out the speaker's, you know, every wish, or was it McLean positioning himself? And I've gotten, I don't know, kind of mixed feedback on that, because some folks will say, well, McLean was always trying to position himself, even if it was just fake it till you make it, kind of like, I'll sit outside the speaker's office so I give off this air of, you know, being the gatekeeper. But then again, you have folks who are like, it doesn't, you know, the speaker must have known at some level that he was being, if nothing else, his name was being used in this way, and he had the power to stop it. But so, Rick, what lies ahead for Speaker Madigan? What kinds of fallout will we see, I guess, for both players in the political sphere, but also more broadly in the state? Because if I'm reading the House rules correctly, no legislative action can happen before a speaker is settled on after that January 13th date, which would set us up for a lot of gridlock, would it not?
Absolutely. And, you know, what worse time to have gridlock than as we discussed this financial situation the state faces. But yeah, until the House organizes itself and has a speaker, they cannot take any legislative action. And so you have, I think we're still really in the early stages of this, because obviously we didn't have a veto session. COVID is preventing people from gathering together. No doubt there have been tons of phone calls going on that That's the way I assume a lot of politicians would rather have it, out of the public eye. But that having been said, you only have Stephanie Kifowit from Oswego as the only identified public challenger to Madigan's speakership. She does not have any substantial or public support for that challenge. Madigan, the master of the 3D chessboard, he's got 54 votes. You need 60. And I think we're into a waiting game right here, and as well as a game of attrition. If the dissidents can't put up somebody, or there can't be, or there's somebody who does not achieve a substantial amount of support, we may just see a series of roll calls for speaker that could last for quite some time. And I think it's Madigan's conclusion that because he has 54, that eventually through attrition, he'll have some of those 19 flip back and support him. But that having been said, a lot of those 19 are in suburban districts that used to be Republican. They're not fully Democratic districts. They're still swing districts. And when you talk to some of those legislators, they'll tell you the first thing on their constituents' mind isn't what they're going to do about X, Y, and Z. It's what are you going to do about Madigan?
Sure. I just don't see a lot of those folks flipping, because they also say, well, it's something I thought a lot about, and it's kind of a moral decision I made. And it's hard to then go back on your word after you make such a statement. But Charlie, I'm going to let you have the last word here. What do you think of the Democrats' contention, you know, in that special investigative committee, that sort of that body should have like a really high bar, like an already existing federal indictment, to recommend disciplinary action by a House member? You know, any thoughts on the committee members' behavior in general?
Well, it occurs to me that the way the committee played out could have been predicted at the time the committee was organized pursuant to the resolution filed by the House Republican leader, Jim Durkin. And I would argue that it was hugely successful from the point of view of the Republicans. They never realistically expected that a committee whose members would be, whose half of the committee would be Democrats loyal to the speaker, was going to take any action against them. On the other hand, they got the publicity, they got the opportunity to complain about how this was a cover-up for Madigan, and it helped keep Mike Madigan in the public eye as the cliche, I guess, I've used it so often, as the Darth Vader of Illinois politics. And while they only managed to pick up one seat in the House, they did manage to defeat Supreme Court Justice Tom Kilbride in his bid for retention, where support for Madigan and the fact that Madigan had helped bankroll his initial campaign was a big issue. And it was also a big factor in the Republicans being able to defeat the graduated tax amendment. So I would argue that Durkin and company got everything they were looking for, and they're probably quite pleased with the result.
Well, we only have a few minutes left here, but I do want to briefly touch on a very lengthy hearing that we saw this week on the coronavirus outbreak at the state-run LaSalle Veterans Home that ultimately has killed 33 residents. Tony, what did we learn from, you know, this week's hearing? And of course, you know, you and your colleague Dave McKinney did a ton of reporting on the Legionnaires outbreak at the Quincy Veterans Home. What new things are you seeing, and what new, I guess, cynically, political liabilities are popping up for everyone involved?
Well, what we're seeing here is you know, this tragedy unfold at this one of these four state-run veterans homes, this one at LaSalle, in real time. And you know, this is, it's awful to hear about and see these stories and see the families coming to grips with what's happening to their relatives who have been at the LaSalle home. There are, I think, many differences that between what's happening here in LaSalle and then what my colleague David Kinney and I covered with the Quincy Veterans Home Legionnaires disease outbreaks. Rick Pearson and his colleagues at the Chicago Tribune did a great story detailing those differences, but ultimately there is a commonality here, which is who bears responsibility for what's happening at this LaSalle home, and then how does that responsibility bearing out? We're seeing questions to the governor consistently about management at the home. Does this outbreak at the home need to go for, does accountability for what this outbreak need to go further up the food chain at the Veterans Affairs Department? And ultimately, should the state be in the business of managing veterans' homes if dangerous circumstances like this are continue leading to the deaths of their residents?
Plenty more discussion and fact-finding that needs to be done there, but it's time now for notes from the field. So we'll go to you, Rick.
Well, when you have a politician that says, quote, there's a lot of trust that's been breached, and I know there's a lot of trust in me that's been breached, and I have a responsibility to build back that trust. That's not a politician. That's not the way you want to start a new year. That's Mayor Lori Lightfoot after these revelations of a wrongful police raid of a social worker's home in February of 2019, where officers went to the wrong address, handcuffed this naked social worker who had just come home from work, and proceeded to make a wrongful search. The mayor's office tried to stop CBS2 Chicago from showing this video, went to court to try to stop it. Lightfoot went after reporters saying that they were using this to promote misinformation. Then she later apologizes, issues this kind of mea culpa about trust, and then we find out that she knew about this incident over a year ago. She's got more than a lot of trust that she needs to rebuild with the Chicago public right now.
Not a good week for Mayor Lightfoot. And Tony?
What I would say is that I've been doing some asking around about what does the campaign for 2022 look like, particularly in the race for Illinois governor. And the results that I'm getting back are A, Pritzker, a spokesman for him, would not say whether the governor's actually going to seek re-election, although I guess I would say that the line, it looks like he's going to, but a spokesman just said that he was focused on handling the pandemic right now. On the Republican side, it's wide open. I have no fewer than 12 people on my list of Republicans who are either being encouraged to run or taking a look at running themselves. And I won't go through the exercise of naming all 12, but this looks like a free-for-all on the Republican side right now. Usually this is the time when people would start announcing that they're thinking of it, and that's not really the case that we're seeing right now.
That's our time for this edition of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Tony Arnold of WBEZ, and Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. You can get a podcast of this show at nprillinois.org or on the NPR One app. Production assistance for today's program was provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Hannah Meisel.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.